96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, January 7th. A neighborhood advocate is out of the gates declaring her candidacy for one of the two at-large seats on the Sarasota City Commission. Flo Entler hopes to take one of the seats currently held by Jen Ahern Koch and Debbie Trice in the November elections this year. Ahern has already filed for re-election. Entler is the president of the Arlington Park Neighborhood Association and is a frequent public speaker at commission meetings. She has experience in bookkeeping and business management, and she currently operates a local fitness business. In the race for the at-large seats, Entler joins Michael Bennett, a former state senator and Manatee County Supervisor of Elections, and Rob Romanicki, husband of the Selby Botanical Gardens CEO. In other election news, James Buchanan endorsed the candidacy of Venice Mayor Nick Pachota to take his Florida House seat. Buchanan picked Pachota from among five Republican candidates running for House District 74. Buchanan is term limited and is now running for Sarasota's state Senate seat, which was held by Joe Gruders. Half a year after state officials threatened to sue or even remove commissioners if they voted to reinstate wetland protections and raise fees on developers, the new chair of the Manatee County Commission announced he would like to see Manatee become a charter county. In his State of the Chair speech yesterday, Tal Siddiqui said creating a county charter, kind of like a local constitution such as Sarasota has it, would strengthen local decision-making. Siddiqui cited the continued efforts of the state government to preempt local authority. Charter changes require public input and voter approval. The state legislative session will kick off next week, and Suncoast state lawmakers are trying to leave their mark. Representative James Buchanan is sponsoring a bill that would force Florida cities and counties to offer online payment methods. Buchanan's bill adds to a list of state preemption bills boxing in local government. It does not address the issue of surcharges for online payments. Recent fees, such as one imposed by the city of Sarasota, raise residents' water bills if they want the convenience of online payment. Meanwhile, Representative Fiona McFarland wants to end $9.99 price tags in Florida. She's sponsoring a bill that would force retailers to round cash prices to the nearest nickel now that the penny is no longer in production. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, January 7th.
Good morning. I'm Tom.
Good morning. I'm Tom Walker. This is the Peace and Justice Report, and we're going to see if we're signaling.
Yeah. Is that going out? Great. We're doing great.
We've got a new board here. Thank you, Pat. Thanks for that wonderful music show. We always appreciate all the DJs, not DJs, they're programmers that work here at WSLR and bring the music they love with no interruption, no commercials, just good music. And thanks for listening. This is, as I said, the Peace and Justice Report. I'm on every other week. Bob Connors is on the intervening weeks. And our guest for the first half hour today is Miles Toter. Miles was on our show last November, and he has called Florida home on and off for 18 years. He moved here in the 1980s after completing his doctorate at the University of Wisconsin. He left a few years later to pursue global development work as a U.S. diplomat in Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and Southeast Asia. He returned to live in Sarasota after retirement from federal service in 2019. And since then, when not on recall to federal service, he has involved himself in growth management, neighborhood planning, and land use disputes. Welcome, Miles.
Good morning, Tom, and good morning, Sarasota.
I'm not sure. Can you hear him okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I can't hear him, but Pat said they could hear him. Okay, that's wonderful. You know, in our talk last month, you shared some of the changes you observed after returning for over 30 years away from Florida, and you talked about many of those changes. Let's start first with home rule. I think I've observed that we're seeing a reversal of the American tradition of home rule and by Tallahassee. And so what is happening, in your opinion, and why does it matter?
Home rule is a big deal, both in this country, where we've curated it over the decades, and overseas. Believe it or not, in places like China, where you have a very strong central government and a single political party, a communist state, their key to development since Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon opened China up to the world, many people believe, is the fact that the Communist Party delegated responsibility for development and a lot of its growth to provincial and local officials.
Wow. Right?
And so for big countries, big complicated countries like the United States, like China, sometimes the best thing to do is not pretend that every place is the same, that
yes,
everybody wants the same thing, that the resource base is ubiquitous across the landscape, and allow local people, give them some discretion to decide what it is they want, what they want to prioritize, what resources they want to exploit, and to make decisions
locally. In China, we're talking about China, right?
Even in China.
Even in China.
And that stunned me when I served there for 3 years, from 2016 to 2019, how important local authorities, provincial authorities, cities, were to China's development. But it shouldn't have surprised me, because I think it was intrinsic to our own development in the U.S. with 50 states, thousands of counties, probably even more cities and townships, where many decisions were pushed down to the local level. Of course, the United States is different than China because we elect our mm-hmm. local and state mm-hmm. and federal officials. There aren't elections in China. But here it's even better, right? So we recognize the differences in terms of opportunities and problems, and then local people who are educated and good citizens elect officials to lead them and make those decisions on their behalf.
Well, that's the theory, but hasn't Tallahassee been taking away a lot of choices? SB 180, which I talked about a couple of weeks ago, aren't they gradually withdrawing withdrawing the authority of the home cities and counties?
Right. There's always going to be a tension between the state, which is a sovereign entity, and your counties and your local jurisdictions, cities, because the counties and the cities are derivative of the state. The state has the ultimate authority and responsibility, and they tend on a good day to delegate a lot of that authority down to local officials. And I think, you know, when I worked in Florida back in the 80s and taught at Florida State, there was a pretty effective delegation, and I think reasonably good relationships between local, county, mm-hmm. and state mm-hmm. authorities. And the pendulum seems to be swinging backward, because the state has set out certain political priorities. For example, you know, parent choice, which now has started a whole movement toward private schools and the use of state tax funds for tuition. Those sorts of political choices, they're trying to, the state is trying to implement, and all of a sudden runs into opposition at the county and at the local level. And the same thing is happening with property taxes. I think Governor DeSantis is trying to find a way to reduce local property taxes, which, as we all know, is the single most important source of revenue.
Sure.
For cities and for counties. And what, again, the state prerogative, the state priority seems to be to make Florida a bit more affordable than it's become recently. I mean, we do have an inflation problem and costs have escalated. And so DeSantis and the GOP seems to be trying to, you know, to reduce the size of government and the amount of money that government takes from its citizens in terms of taxes. And so they're trying to reduce property taxes. And that, of course, runs into opposition at the city and county level, where property taxes are probably our single most important source of revenue, followed by sales taxes.
Right. Huh.
Yeah. So this is sort of a tug of war. It happens, you know, this isn't the first time it's happened. But, you know, we have to keep in mind that the premise that local people know their area better and that, people want to either be a part or to feel that government works for them. And the best way to do that is to push responsibility to the lowest level possible and for local people like us to hold our local authorities accountable.
You know, even on the local level, though, you've made another point that sometimes they substitute political judgment for professional judgment, and they make rules and laws without knowing the background or the technical issues involved, especially in the area of growth and development. True?
Yeah, it's true. And I tend to be more partial toward the professionals than the politicians.
Sure.
Having never stood for public office and never served as an elected official. But, you know, again, there's a tension. The professionals have all this education and all this experience dealing with very specific, but very consequential problems.
Yeah.
And, many of them have professional licenses and belong to professional associations where they maintain their credentials, where they keep up to date with new developments in the field. So they're very skilled people. And then our politicians, I mean, many of them come from a professional background, but a lot of them have moved beyond being professionals and having technical expertise to being elected representatives where they have to make certain judgments. And so, again, you're going to have this tension between the people who, you know, spend their lives and are up to date and current on highly technical, complicated issues, and then the politicians who at the end of the day have the last word. And it's interesting to watch our county officials, and I assume it happens in the city of Sarasota, try to thread that needle between using their professional staff to inform them to analyze things like traffic and wastewater disposal. I mean, all the things that local government has to deal with, and the politicians who ultimately have the responsibility and the last word. And you know, I think it's important for our elected officials to be mindful that they have this expertise at their disposal. These professionals work for them report to them. And they should at least consider very, very seriously what the so-called experts, whether they're engineers or planners or public health specialists, have to say on various issues.
So why is another question you've posed in the past? Why is balancing of private property rights with public interest so important and in our present and our future? It seems like there's always a battle between private property rights and the public interest. Who, for instance, benefits from those decisions and who pays for the growth?
I mean, Florida is ground zero for that balancing, the challenge of balancing private property and the public interest. And as a planner and as someone who studied planning for many years, we've studied that problem, extensively, and many of us have been involved in the public policy formulations, the writing of the laws, and followed the litigation, in the courts. And let's be clear. I mean, private property is sort of the bedrock principle of our market-based democracy. Okay, there's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, your private property is not an intrinsic right. It's a right given to you and protected by the state.
Right.
And so everything that we own, everything that we accomplish, is facilitated and to a certain extent guaranteed by the state. And so, you know, again, it's a balancing act between the two. And Florida is interesting because we keep talking about how important it is to be able to do what you wish to do with your property, with your, mm-hmm. with your land, right? Almost to the point now where the argument behind reducing the property tax is that it shouldn't be allowed because it's taking away something from your some people would argue, absolute right to that property. Mm. But that just doesn't square with the real world, right? Everything in that property is valuable because government protects it. Government creates the infrastructure that makes it productive, right? They make sure they keep track of your title so that if anyone challenges it, mm-hmm. it's not going to be taken away from you. And so it's not unreasonable to agree that government needs to impose certain restrictions on the way you use that property and how you benefit from it. So it's an important distinction. I will say in places like China, which, as I pointed out earlier, did very well with home rule and with decentralized governance.
Okay.
Private property is not nearly as sacrosanct as it is here. Now, people have they have the right to use the property. I don't think they have the ownership in the way that we enjoy in the United States. So I think, you know, restrictions on the use of property are sensible, because the way you use your property impacts the way your neighbor uses their property.
Right.
So there's a public interest in the way property is used, and I think it's not unreasonable to impose restrictions through zoning and other statutes, as well as to insist that people who own property pay their fair share of the costs of making that property productive, i.e. the roads, the water systems, yes. the wastewater, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's an interesting debate that goes on, but we need to listen to both sides of that debate and make sure that private property as an institution remains private, but agree that the public interest is just as important.
Hmm. Okay, here's another question for you. Considering the interaction and conflicts between economy, the environment, and social objectives, working for sustainable growth, how do we manage the process of change? I don't know. What do you think?
So America's big contribution to the world, a lot of it happened during the Nixon administration. And while I wasn't a big fan of President Nixon, mm-hmm. He accomplished a few things. Obviously, he brought China into the world because China had been isolated.
Sure.
So him and Henry Kissinger brought China into the world economy. But more importantly, under President Nixon, a policy called the National Environmental Policy Act was signed into law. And that act, which came sort of at the end of our Industrial Revolution, where we had fouled our air, our water, and our soil from decades and decades of heavy manufacturing. That act was intended to be able to find some sense of balance in the future between the needs of economic growth, maintaining an environment that protected our health, safety, and welfare, and social objectives in terms of reducing poverty, giving people opportunity, and again safeguarding public health. So that was a revolutionary concept, and the law that got put in place brought about such things which we forget today as public hearings. So think about it. Before NEPA was signed into law in 71, there was no such thing as public involvement in government decisions. And NEPA mandated it by law wherever federal money was involved, and then states like Florida and all the other 50 states followed suit and decided that more public involvement in important public decisions was necessary. And so that's why today we go through the misery of public hearings, why people drag themselves down to the county commission or to the city commission and have a chance to speak, usually for 3 minutes or 5 minutes, so it's not long, but they have a chance to opine on important decisions that their elected representatives are going to make. So a lot of good things came from NEPA, from the National Environmental Policy Act, promulgated under a conservative Republican administration, who understood that Americans are smart, they have a point of view, and their voice should be heard, not just at the ballot box, but on specific issues when it comes to growth and development and the use of resources and the use of public money.
So I think we may have already answered this. Well, my next question was, why is community involvement and neighborhood planning and consultation, tapping into local knowledge, why is that, and as part of the comp plan, why is that process so important?
Yeah, again, it's trying to tap the knowledge, the expertise, and the views, the opinions,
yes,
of residents at the neighborhood or at the local level. And, you know, it's... I'm sure it's painful for our elected representatives to have to sit through that, but it's the only way for them to hear both sides of an argument. Mm-hmm. One side, a developer or a landowner who wants to do something with their land that mm-hmm. requires government approval mm-hmm. and perhaps government infrastructure, and the other, the neighbors adjacent to that property and in the immediate vicinity who are going to be impacted by that. So it's, you know, it's time consuming, nothing efficient about it. You could ask people who sit through those things. There's a certain entertainment value to it because you hear all sorts of views from all sorts of people,
yep,
including us retirees, who sometimes are accused of being in the way of progress. But it needs to happen, because again, even though we elect our representatives and they're supported by these professional experts like planners and engineers and environmentalists, at the end of the day, the people in this country have something to say. And it's often something that's thoughtful, that's well thought through.
Sure.
It's often based on fact. Sometimes it's based on emotion or feeling, but whatever it's based on is important, and it needs to be heard and put into the public record.
What do you think of term limits? Because, you know, we have it in state legislature and they in the city governments, but not in the U.S. Senate. We reelect them. I'm sorry, but not in the Supreme Court. So term limits are good or bad? What do you think? Because you accumulate expertise, but then they leave and you have to generate new, or you have people who don't know that same history.
Yeah. I mean, all of us have a tendency, I think it's a human tendency for us to hang around longer than we should. I mean, let's just be honest about that. That's human nature. And so when I served overseas as an American diplomat and my focus was on governance and democracy, many of the officials in foreign countries, at the national, local level would ask us questions about how we do things in the U.S. And term limits often came up because they knew themselves that their own leaders had a tendency to hang around longer than they should.
Forever.
Right?
Yeah.
So when I was in Beijing, in China, right before retiring from the Foreign Service, Xi Jinping, the current leader of China, decided that the new 10-year limit that China had decided after Mao Zedong passed away was, you know, was malleable. You know, they had several successions of 10-year term limited prime ministers, presidents,
right.
And they found that it was actually good that because of human nature of people sticking around longer than they should, you need to have a term limit, particularly on high level positions.
Well, at least for re-election.
At least for re-election. So Xi Jinping, the current leader of China, decided that no, he's going to stick around longer than 10 years. And so I asked my Chinese colleagues mm-hmm. privately, usually over a cup of coffee at Starbucks, mm-hmm. What they thought of their president's announcement. That he was just gonna stick around because they really needed him.
Right. What did they say?
And they're very careful because these are all people who belong to the Communist Party. So they're very careful what they said. And what they said is, we learn from history that when our leaders stick around too long, nothing good happens to us Chinese people.
Huh.
And that's all they would say, right? They didn't criticize the president, right? They didn't criticize his decision that only he can lead the country into the future.
Right.
But they made the point that people sticking around too long in high public office is probably not in the best interest of the country.
Mm.
And that there's plenty of other people with youthful enthusiasm, with new ideas, and with a lot more energy and maybe good conscience who could lead the country.
We've got about five more minutes left in our half hour. Here's a question, maybe the final question. Why are the independent accountability institutions which monitor and prosecute fraud, waste, and abuse, why are they so essential? And why is it an issue now in the United States?
You know, I've seen it from both sides. When I was economic development expert, and when I managed some big American foreign aid programs, I was pretty regularly scrutinized by these investigators from the federal government, mm-hmm. By inspector generals, by auditors, by the FBI. Because we were using large amounts of public money. We were trying to do some very complicated, risky things in foreign countries. And there was plenty of opportunity for fraud, waste, and abuse. I mean, our foreign aid programs are important, but they were also operating in pretty hostile settings where things could and often did go wrong. So I felt the impact as someone responsible for managing large sums of money, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars at a time, of our accountability community of these experts, and so I can appreciate what they do. But once I became a government official. Mm-hmm. And I had the ultimate responsibility for these things.
Right.
I kind of resented it, right? I felt that these accountability officials, our inspector generals, our government accountability office in Congress, law enforcement, FBI, I felt that they were second guessing what I was doing, right? So it kind of depends on where you stand. But look, whenever we're using public money, we're trying to produce goods and services sort of outside of the normal market, where there would be checks and balances on how much you can charge and how mm-hmm. you use the money and whether or not you actually deliver it. The market is very efficient in many cases. But when you do it in the public sector, you need these watchdogs.
Yes.
You need these checks. There's huge amounts of money at stake. There's some very ambitious things we're trying to accomplish. And you need someone else who is disinterested but knows where to look for the dead bodies to watch and see what's going on and report to Congress, who in the first place appropriates the tax money to pay for these mm-hmm. things. So we're in trouble right now. You know, our government is getting ahead of the accountability community. They've done everything they can to sort of marginalize it and get it out of the way.
Yeah.
But having seen it from both sides, I cheer on the accountability community because we still need it. We still need someone else watching what we do, not second guessing necessarily, but identifying where we could have done better mm-hmm. and holding us accountable.
Thank you, Miles Toter. I know you got to go now. You got a meeting with the mayor this morning. What are you going to talk about there?
We're talking about our sister cities program. We have a relationship with the city of Sarasota, and we have six sister cities around the world.
Uh-huh.
This is a person-to-person diplomacy, and I'm going to meet the new mayor, talk to her about what we're doing, and explain to her some of the new sister cities that we hope to bring online in the next year.
Well, I hope you have local celebrations or events that we can attend to learn more about those cities.
Sure.
They're paired with our city to be similar. And what population and growth and so forth.
And many of them have a tourist component like we do and are sitting in a very environmentally attractive but uh-huh. fragile in a setting. Uh-huh. So we learn from our sister cities. They learn from us. And as a retired diplomat, this is my way of continuing to be involved in international relations at a person-to-person level, which is more fun than doing it for the government.
Right. Well, I hope we can learn a lot and continue to share that knowledge. Miles Toter, former diplomat, still doing the work of a diplomat, and appreciate your being here today, Miles. Good luck with your meeting with the mayor.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
Good luck with the Sister Cities program.
Yeah. Thank you.
Our next guest today is my friend, Kathy Bryant. Kathy is the chief executive officer of the Streets of Paradise. She has been with Streets of Paradise since before it was officially born, and is as CEO, she leads what she calls a trauma-informed, people-first approach rooted in dignity, compassion, and action. Under her leadership, Streets of Paradise has become a critical lifeline for hundreds of individuals and families each year, offering furnished homes, disaster relief, mobile showers, and laundry, and a sense of belonging where it's needed most. Welcome, Kathy.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, good. Stay close to the microphone. You're doing great. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I was hoping you would refresh our memory. Tell us about how Streets of Paradise was formed and then and everything it does now. So you take it away.
Sure. So good to see you. It's been, what, a couple months since I've seen you, so I'm so excited to be with you and
thank you.
Tell you what all's going on in our world. So Streets of Paradise started very informally as street outreach only. We were feeding people on the streets back in 2015, 2016. Fun fact, one of my favorite things, we've never missed a week of food share. That's what we call our...
So you take the food to the people.
To the people. So we've never missed a week of feeding people on the streets since 2016. Sometimes we've done more, but we've never missed a week. We currently feed on Sundays. So we On Sunday mornings.
Uh-huh.
We chose that day since the pandemic because it's the only day that food isn't available in Sarasota for the people on the streets. So Sunday mornings is the only day that there's no Resurrection House, Remnant Cafe, other ways of getting food on the streets. So... Anyways, we started in 2016 as outreach, building relationships with people on the streets, and encouraging them to connect with agencies that could help them find housing. We kept doing that until 2018 when we became a 501c3.
Mm-hmm.
In 2019, we were approached by the city to provide furniture and household items for people coming off the streets.
Right. So, you furnish those empty apartments, right?
We do. So, the federal government made it a law that one could not move into federally funded housing without it being furnished.
I didn't know that.
Because people were failing at an 87% rate.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that knowledge, we were like, well, I want to see what it looks like for an 87% success rate.
Mm-hmm.
So in March of 2019, we started furnishing homes. And I think one of the greatest gifts of that Streets of Paradise has been given from the very beginning is that everything we do first has, you know, we all have an idea of what things will look like.
Mm-hmm.
And our firsts are always the things that are like completely not what we had in our idea. So when I showed up to the first move-in, is what we call it when we furnish somebody's house, you know, we rented a what we called a warehouse. It was a 600-square-foot storage unit, really. But we used the $2,000 that we had in the bank to rent this storage unit.
Mm-hmm.
We had no trucks of our own. We had my Jeep and a couple people with a truck and a trailer that we were furnishing homes with. So we'd pick up donations from all across Sarasota and Manatee counties.
I want to point out, you do pick up. You're one of the few services that for donated furniture that does pick up.
We do.
I've given a lot of furniture.
You have. And I definitely want to go back to that piece because it's way better than when you experienced it. And I want to talk about that. But when we showed up to the first move-in, I had an idea because of the time on the streets, the people that I had seen, and sort of just, you know, the guilt of my own ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I was assuming that it was going to be probably somebody in their 60s, 70s, probably a veteran, mm-hmm. probably a man.
Mm-hmm.
And when we showed up at their house, it was an 18-year-old young man aging out of foster care.
Mm. That's important.
And I think that that was one of the greatest gifts in that program specifically, because that is what we see the most of, is the families and younger people. Right now, we're furnishing about 25 homes a week.
Wow.
And I would say most of those are people aging out of foster care, people integrating back with their children, people coming out of programs, drug and alcohol recovery programs, things like that. So it's been an interesting journey going from March of 2019 to November of 2019 when we got our first truck. Allison Werner, who was at that time Couture Real Estate, gave us our first box truck. It was a 20-year-old U-Haul, and we drove it to death, let me tell you. And it was wonderful. It was the biggest gift that we had ever had, and furnished about 2,000 people's homes.
Well, who makes these apartments available? Do they have to pay for them? How do they find those new apartments that you furnish? How does that happen?
In a lot of different ways, for as many ways as there are people.
Okay.
So some of them are people coming out of programs. So they may get government subsidies or grants from their particular agency. Mm-hmm. So they may pay for 6 months' rent or something like that. Same way with children aging out of foster care, there may be some grants or some private funding for that particular agency. What I see the most right now seems to be people that are co-sharing homes and making it work within their own smaller communities. So maybe they're moving into a room or a
so you could furnish that room, right?
Yep. So we do a lot of part furnishings, and we do a lot of furnishings for people to stay in their homes. Maybe they need food. Maybe they need hygiene items. Maybe they need a new bed. Maybe there was an infestation.
And they call you and...
And we redo it, yeah. You know, if you lose your housing in Sarasota or Manatee counties, or you find yourself without housing, it's really hard to get there. There's a lot... It's expensive to get first month's rent and deposit. It's hard to find the places. So if we can keep people in their houses, taking off things on their budget, we just this last week, we started a new partnership with the SPCA. Humane Society. So, so we give them all of our dog food and cat food and supplies, and then they're able to give it out. Mm-hmm. We do get it from donations, and so it was exciting to form that partnership. It was kind of a cool partnership. Side story, we had cats at the warehouse that needed care, and so they provided all the care for it. So that's been a huge shout-out to them, taking care of all the creatures.
Well, speaking of your warehouse, I just toured a few weeks ago your new facility out near the airport. I want you to talk about what it is, what you do with it, how you came by it, and what you do there. Tell us a lot about that.
Sure. So our warehouse that we're in now, that we've been in since our very first one in 2019, is at the Airport Mall, which is right behind the airport, 8251 15th Street East. Mm-hmm. And we've been there since 2020, and in that spot. And so we also had a place that some of you would be familiar with downtown.
I remember.
And it was a great space. It was a great community space, a great place to bring community together and build those purposeful relationships, which is such a huge part of what we do.
It was in the Planned Parenthood building, right?
Yep, in the front part of that. So we were there for many years. They actually gave us the space in order to allow us to do showers there. Some of you might remember we during the pandemic, we were given showers on 4th Street with the fire department, and then moved over to Planned Parenthood as it was needed. So we had that space for many years. It was amazing. It was a great place for building relationships. And they did something different in January. And so at the time, you know, they had given it to us for nearly nothing. And as a not-for-profit, those kinds of things definitely matter. And in these years that we've had it, we built a relationship also with Red Cross and Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. And so during storms or during crises, that space became a disaster hub of sorts.
Sure.
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't really equipped, but we're pretty used to making things work when you do things on the streets. So we had the mobile showers. We could bring in crock pots. Planned Parenthood had electricity and generators. So we were able to open that up as a disaster recovery space, a cooling center, charging, a recharging place after storms. And so when we lost that space in January and moved over just back to the warehouse, you know, we decided that we weren't going to do anything additionally, like we didn't really have the funding, or maybe we didn't have the need. And what became really apparent quickly was, you know, we talk all the time about furnishing homes for people and creating spaces where they can have community.
Right.
And the importance of having, you know, a couch and a cup if you're going to build community. If you can have someone in your home, those relationships grow and you can have more support.
Sure.
So what we found in those few months that we didn't have a space was that what we preach is actually what we have to practice, that having a space where people can come to in community matters so much. And so the space across the hall from our warehouse, which was an old mall.
Yes.
And originally, years and years ago, for those of you who have been around a long, long time, I'm guessing in the 70s, if anybody has the fun facts of this, please tell me. But that space that we're in now used to be the Sarasota Ballet.
Oh.
And our warehouse side was their props storage.
Okay.
So we developed it out with the help of Red Cross and Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. We developed it into what would be a disaster hub if needed. Mm-hmm. And when it's not needed as disasters, it's fully functional as a community center.
Yeah, I want you to tell us all you do there. How many square feet is that, by the way? It was a huge place.
It is huge. Between both sides, it's about 8,000 square feet.
Okay. So tell us what you do there now. And what not only during disasters, but week to week, right?
Yeah, week to week. So it is a national model. So it's called a resiliency hub. In a national model, that it is available during disasters. It has Starlink. It has solar. It has the mobile showers and laundry and ways to cook without electricity if we needed to, or with electricity with solar.
Okay.
But when it's not, the goal is to make it into a community center, a resiliency hub, a place where people are coming home to. So when there is a disaster, because we're all going to face disasters in our life, whether that's climate or personal, there's a place to come home to. You're not coming to a strange space. You're coming to a place where that's already been community for you. So we have open mic nights. We have poetry. We've had game nights.
These are ongoing things you have there.
Yeah. We always have... since we started, we've been having yoga there. And a lot of people question the yoga. They're like, did you open a yoga center? No, we did not open a yoga center. We have yoga there in the community center.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of reasons. One, it funds what we really do, which is furnish homes. And we have amazing teachers who teach different levels, including restorative, and it's an Anasara-based yoga practice. So it's really focused on alignment and community, which is, again, so much a part of our core values. So it was a good match, and it helps support the mission, which is obviously the moving and the disaster relief.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 9 yoga classes in there a week.
This is ongoing, not during emergencies. This is ongoing at your center at the airport.
Correct. So everyone's invited. There are 8-week sessions, and they're meant to increase your practice, level up. And there's different levels that you can begin with.
You have beginners?
We do. We have beginners. We have restorative, which is just a beautiful practice. It's usually done in candlelight and has sound bowl healings along with it. That's on Monday night. And then we have a level 1 and a level 2 and a level 3, which is really advanced. And then starting the end of this month, on the last Saturday of every month, we're going to have music for the mission. So it's kirtan, it's meditative music, it's... resistance music, some of those old songs. So we're excited about that.
Concerts? Is this all on your website?
It will be. It's within next week. It'll all be on the website. It is on our social media, but the rest of it'll be on the. It'll be on the website pretty soon.
So you pay a little bit, whatever, and you do the yoga or hear the music or whatever, and you meet friends and people.
Yes.
And you probably find new volunteers that way too. Right?
We do. And the donations and the bits that get paid fund the mission. So that's the purpose of that. The biggest purpose is having the community there.
Okay. So you're building a community hub, a community center where people come together. That's wonderful. I know on your website you had some things you're planning to do for the future, case management, Heartspeaks roundtables, something called Beneath the Noise. Talk about all those things that are coming up.
Mm-hmm. So we have really been in a space of growth right now.
Hmm.
Back in August, September, I get my dates wrong. We were gifted through the Red Cross from General Motors two new electric vans.
Yes, I saw those. Yeah. Impressive. Brand new, right?
You. They're beautiful. They're electric. They look like Amazon vans, except they're white.
Right.
And Red Cross paid for all the branding on it. So we have these two amazing vans. And through two separate grants, one from Gulf Coast Community Foundation and one through a donor who chooses to be anonymous, we were able to hire six new people to drive those three new vehicles.
Okay.
So we have all three vehicles now on the road with six mover drivers on the trucks. And it was such an amazing – I have to tell you a story, Tom.
Sure.
You'll love this story. So when we decided to hire, when we were given the grant and had the ability to hire mover drivers, we chose to expand the program that we already do, which is to expand within our community. So we hired people that had been in, had received our services or had mm-hmm. been in partnership with us.
Okay.
And so people that had either gotten a move-in or maybe their mom did or maybe their
– That's a good idea. You hired them.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Because we wanted people that had been
knew what it meant.
Knew what it meant. Exactly. Because we're not just trying to furnish people's house. We're trying to make a home that's worth holding on to. So we hired these guys and ladies, and the first week that one of the teams was out, they were at a move-in, and I'll make the story shorter than it is, but they were in partnership with Equal SRQ, which is right here on Fruitvale. It's a recovery center, because that's one of the things we love to do is overlap all of our services and have as many partners as we can mm-hmm. That are doing mission-aligned work, because it's another thing we do with the hub is rent out the space for other not-for-profit agencies that may need some of this space. Anyways, they went on to move in. While they were there, he said, this place looks familiar. I think that this is near where I was living when I was taken into foster care with my brother. And as he was doing the move, he ended up meeting his sister, who he had not had contact with in 17 years.
Wow.
And then being able to connect. And then we were all together, all of the mover drivers and the sister and his brother, who works at Equal SRQ as a peer mentor. We were all together at their event recently, and it was absolutely amazing to see that community coming together and that loving well into these spaces. So that's the goal. That is actually like one of my favorite stories of who we truly are, is mm-hmm. making community and building these relationships and making safety nets for everyone.
Mm.
So your question, though, was where are we going? We implemented a scheduling system. So donors like you who struggled in the past, I know this and will completely own it. You struggled in the past with getting a hold of us or getting an appointment or having that clear communication, which thank you for all the grace that you gave us. You can now go on to our website and schedule your own appointment when you want it.
Wow.
And then you will get text and email confirmation that it's done and that we're on our way, and a receipt following it. So we're really happy about that. So you can schedule your own donation.
Wow.
And move-ins are being done within a week or two. So there's not as much wait time. I say 2 weeks as if they're in the far edges of Manatee or Sarasota. It might take us a little longer.
That's really fast, right?
It's so good because we went from having several hundred backlog moves to we're doing about 25 to 30 a week now.
25, 30 what?
Move-ins a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're busy.
We're really busy, but it's amazing.
And how do the people coming out of, for instance, foster care, mm-hmm. I've had a lot of programs about foster care. I know they're vulnerable to traffickers, all sorts of things, and you're giving them a home and a furnished home, a place to live for at least a while, you and other agencies. Mm-hmm. Do you keep up with them later? Do you keep in touch?
Great question. That's part of the part of the programming right now. That's part of the goals. We have a shared intern through Equal SRQ, Queens Against Domestic Violence, and us, funded through Community Foundation. And her focus with us on the every week that she's with us is developing that outreach and those communications to be able to stay in contact, to have them into the hub, or to perhaps assign them a peer. That's it. That's in process right now of how that's going to go. But that's her focus with us. She'll be with us for 15 weeks, and we hope to continue it after that. So we're really excited about that because, yes, the goal is that's part of, you know, the focus of the hub is having community always and to be able to.
Do you publish a schedule as to what's going on each week or each day? Or?
Yep. It's just gotten developed and will be on the website within the week.
That would be helpful. Yeah.
Yes.
I noticed one of the things on your website was Heart Speaks Roundtables. What are they?
Just groups to be able to, and groups that are specific to phases of life. Groups that are, I was just talking to a guy the other day who was a young widow. He was widowed when he was 30, and he was like, you know, what I really needed then was a group. And so either finding them or developing them, and then specific to the journeys that many of our clients are going through with finding new housing or sustaining their housing and bringing in appropriate speakers and community influences that can encourage, teach, guide, peer mentor, or professionally mentor somebody through these kinds of processes. And then just the peer support of each other that are going through this together, having that, you know, you and I have sat together enough times that whilst maybe we are exactly peers in age or what we're doing, but we are
83.
Yeah, but your wisdom has guided me through a lot of dark moments. So having those opportunities to sit together over a cup of coffee or at a table together with sweet music or something, you know, it's healing.
All right. So let me see. I had a question. What the best way for somebody to volunteer? They call you, or is there a place on the website to help out? I think I might like to do some volunteering.
I think I would love that. There is a place on the website. If you go on there,
it's called streetsofparadise.org, right?
Streetsofparadise.org. Sorry, that would be important. our phone number is on there. For those of you who have struggled getting a hold of us also, it is now being answered by four amazing volunteers that rotate that phone. So you can get a hold of us via phone. It is on the website. It is on Google. And then also there's a way to, again, set up your donation for pickup, and there's also a way to do the application if you're the one needing furniture, and there's a way to do the application if you want to come volunteer, because we need lots and lots of volunteers.
Wow. So this is amazing that since 8 years ago, you know, when you first started. Wow. I think you need more publicity, not just this little program, but you know, we've got to tell more people about this.
Well, bring me all the volunteers. We can bring me all the volunteers. We can get it out there.
Okay. All right. So, anything else? We've got about 5 more minutes. What do you think? What do you want to tell people about?
I just want to encourage everybody to come in and see us, set up a tour, or just stop by.
Just telephone or stop by?
Yeah, sure, you know? Just stop by. Our hours are 10 to 5, Monday through Thursday. Monday through Thursday. By appointments on Friday and Saturday. Sunday is food share, so everybody's invited to food share.
Food share's out there?
Out there. So we start there. So people bring a food item, whether that's or a shareable plate, a potluck.
On Sundays.
And then we serve it up into balanced meals, and a few of the street teams take it out on the streets.
What's the deadline for getting the meal there before you go out?
11. We're there by 10:30, and then we pack it up, and the street team takes it out on the streets with some hygiene items and things like that.
So if people want to donate food, extra food they don't need, or they have cooked or whatever, they can bring that to you before.
Yep.
To 10? Did you say 10?
10:30.
10:30.
Mm-hmm. So we do have a food program as well in partnership with Community Harvest, mm-hmm. an amazing group that harvests food from local farmers okay. and backyards. If you have fruit trees or items of food in your yard, they'll
Great
come
idea.
And glean it.
Great idea.
And then they bring it to us. And so yesterday, through two amazing gifts, Lickety Split, which is a local junk removal or hauling place, they donated 7,000 pounds of food, rice and
That's
coconut milk
That's
and oatmeal. And then we had Community Harvest and another donation from Publix. So we had all of this food. We had a little over 8,000 pounds of food yesterday morning. And within 4 hours, it was all gone to 108 households.
You just took it around. You didn't.
I mean, no, they came and got it.
They came and got it.
Yeah.
And how did they know about it? You called them up? These are former clients? Or?
So a lot of them were former clients. It was done via email, social media, and
phone
calls.
Oh, social media.
Yeah.
What social media platform do you prefer?
We have Instagram and we have Facebook.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got to remember to check those.
So, but for the future, we always have, well, I shouldn't say always. We are hopeful. We always have. Right now it's harvest season, so we always have. Because of Community Harvest, we always get the produce from all the farmers markets and mm-hmm. amazing bread from some of those bakers. And there's this community is so giving. We put out a call a few months ago when SNAP was having an issue with food, and we had such a big need, and we're getting requested so much, and the community really came through with food. And so we haven't had a deficit. We haven't had extra, but we haven't had a deficit. So we're really grateful for the perishable and non-perishable foods.
Do restaurants and markets donate food that may be slightly old but still edible? Is that a thing anymore?
Sometimes, not as much anymore because of risks, risk to them.
Sure,
liabilities and stuff. But it happens when it can. Mm-hmm. I would say most people are willing to do it when they can. But we have food every Monday and until we run out. Okay. We try to update our social media as quickly as possible if it's ran out. But
and this is all on your website, I hope.
It is. It is.
That's an amazing group. It always has been. Thank you for all you do, you and your group. I know you've got a board behind you. You take contributions, of course.
We do.
You're going to do the what's the fundraising thing we're going to do next year?
The Giving Challenge.
What's it called?
The Giving Challenge.
Oh, yes.
Well, yes, on Tuesday. The
Giving Challenge.
April 15th, 14th.
Okay.
Yeah.
So people can contribute.
Super excited about
and
that.
And mainly they should contact you and maybe go out and see what this beautiful place looks like now.
It's amazing. Yeah, come see it. I'd love to give anybody a tour. If you're looking for space to rent, it's a lot of space. We have a lot of tools to make it usable. So we have like a projector. We have a big screen. If you wanted a movie night of that or
a
presentation, we do. We have a stage, a cafe. It's not really a cafe.
Wow.
It's a little place to sit and have some coffee. Uh-huh. And we'd love to have you come. We have workspaces if you're working from home and want to find a little nook or a cubby hole to come work in community. We'd love to have you.
There's nothing you don't do. That's amazing.
We just want it to be a community space.
Sure. And you still have that shower truck you bought so many years ago?
We do. We mostly use it for disasters.
Okay.
It was in service all of 2023 when we needed it for hurricanes. It was the county used it for their shelters because it is ADA and we could run it.
Do you speak all languages there? Do you have somebody who speaks Spanish, for instance?
We do. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Not all languages, but we do have somebody that speaks Spanish and can usually find somebody that speaks the others because we have a pretty great group of volunteers with big hearts.
Yes. All right. 1 minute left. I'm talking to Kathy Bryant, CEO of Streets of Paradise, about her new facilities and all her new offerings. You should check out her website, which is streetsofparadise.org. I'm so impressed. And you've talked about your future plans. What you got? Oh, 30 seconds. What?
Well, 30 seconds, it would be amiss to say that we always need funding.
Always need funding.
We're not for profit, you have to say it. We are completely funded by the community.
No special grants or foundations or anything like that?
Local foundations.
Local foundations.
No state or government funding.
Okay.
And so we're just funded and supported and motored by our community, and we're really grateful for everybody.
Wow, we're so lucky to have you. Thank you, Kathy Bryant, streetsofparadise.org. I want everybody to go there and check it out right now. After you listen to Amy Goodman, of course, which is coming up in 4 seconds, this is Tom Walker with Peace and Justice Report.
Host of Democracy Now!, you're listening to WSLR-LP.
Right now. After you listen to Amy Goodman, of course, which is coming up in 4 seconds, this is Tom Walker.